Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for November 15, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. Headlines in today's paper: Israeli military says it entered Gaza hospital. Army has surrounded the facility. The Israeli military entered Gaza's largest hospital early Wednesday, conducting what it called a precise and targeted operation against Hamas in a specified area of the facility, which has been the site of a standoff with the militant group. The army surrounded the facility as part of its ground offensive against Hamas. Israeli authorities claim the militants conceal military operations in the facility, but with hundreds of patients and medical personnel inside, Israeli authorities refrained from entering. In recent weeks, Israeli Defense Forces, quote, publicly warned time and again that Hamas' continued military use of the Shifa Hospital jeopardizes its protected status under international law, quote, the military said. Yesterday, the IDF conveyed to the relevant authorities in Gaza once again that all military activities within the hospital must cease within 12 hours. Unfortunately, it did not. Hamas denied the Israeli accusations that it uses the hospital for cover. Military officials gave no further details, but said they were taking steps to avoid harm to civilians. The operation unfolded after the military seized broader control of northern Gaza on Tuesday. The army said it captured the territory's legislature building, the Hamas police headquarters, and a compound housing Hamas military intelligence headquarters, gains that carry high symbolic value in the country's quest to crush the ruling Hamas. Their strategic value was unclear. Meanwhile, Israeli defense officials said they agreed to allow fuel shipments into the Gaza Strip for humanitarian operations. It's the first time Israel allowed fuel into the besieged territory since the Hamas militant group's bloody invasion of Israel on October 7. Inside some of the captured buildings, soldiers held up the Israeli flag and military flags in celebration. In a nationally televised news conference, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said, Hamas lost control of northern Gaza, and Israel made significant gains in Gaza City. Asked about the time frame for the war, Gallant said, we're talking about long months, not a day or two. One Israeli commander in Gaza, identified only as Lieutenant Colonel Gilad, said in a video that his forces near Shifa Hospital seized government buildings, schools, and residential buildings where they found weapons and eliminated fighters. For days, the Israeli army encircled Shifa Hospital. Hundreds of patients, staff, and displaced people were trapped inside. With supplies dwindling and no electricity to run incubators and other life-saving equipment. After days without refrigeration, morgue staff on Tuesday dug a mass grave in the yard for more than 120 bodies, officials said. Elsewhere, the Palestinian Red Crescent said Tuesday it evacuated patients, doctors, and displaced families from another Gaza City hospital, Al-Quds. Israel vowed to end Hamas rule in Gaza after the October 7 attack on Israel, in which Hamas militants killed some 1,200 people and took roughly 240 hostages. The Israeli government acknowledged it doesn't know what it will do with the territory after Hamas' defeat. The onslaught, one of the most intense bombardments so far in this century, has been disastrous for Gaza's 2.3 million Palestinians. More than 1,200 people, two-thirds of them women and minors, have been killed in Gaza, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry in Ramallah. About 2,700 people have been reported missing. The ministry's count does not differentiate between civilian and militant deaths. Fighting has raged for days around Shifa Hospital, a complex several city blocks across at the center of Gaza City that has now turned into a cemetery, its director said in a statement. The health ministry said 40 patients, including 3 babies, died since Shifa's emergency generator ran out of fuel on Saturday. Another 36 babies are at risk of dying because there is no power for incubators, according to the ministry. The Israeli military said it started an effort to transfer incubators to Shifa, but they would be useless without electricity, said Christian Lindmeier, a World Health Organization spokesman. The health ministry proposed evacuating the hospital with the supervision of the International Committee of the Red Cross and transferring the patients to hospitals in Egypt, but has not received any response, ministry spokesman Ashraf Al-Kidra said. While Israel says it is willing to allow staff and patients to evacuate, some Palestinians who have made it out say Israel forces fired at evacuees. Israel says its claims of a Hamas command center in and beneath Shifa are based on intelligence, but has not provided visual evidence to support them. Denying the claims, the Gaza Health Ministry said it invited international organizations to investigate the facility. The evacuation of the Al-Quds Hospital followed more than 10 days of siege, during which medical and humanitarian supplies were prevented from reaching the hospital, Palestinian Red Crescent officials said. The White House's National Security Council spokesperson, John Kirby, said the U.S. has unspecified intelligence that Hamas and another Palestinian militants use Shifa and other hospitals and tunnels underneath them to support military operations and hold hostages. Kirby said the U.S. doesn't support airstrikes on hospitals and does not want to see a firefight in a hospital where innocent people are trying to get care. Israel says it has killed several thousand fighters, including important mid-level commanders, while 46 of its own soldiers have been killed in Gaza. In recent days, Hamas rocket fire into Israel, constant throughout the war, has waned, though 2 people were wounded Tuesday in a rocket attack on Tel Aviv. Families and supporters of the roughly 240 people being held hostage by Hamas started a protest march from Tel Aviv and expect to reach Jerusalem on Saturday. The second article on the front page is entitled Warming Hurting All Regions. Climate assessment says it's hurting people across the United States. Revved up climate change now permeates Americans' daily lives with harm that is, quote, already far-reaching and worsening across every region of the United States, close quote, a massive new government report says. The National Climate Assessment, which comes out every 4 to 5 years, was released Tuesday with details that bring climate change's impacts down to a local level. Overall, it paints a picture of a country warming about 60% faster than the world as a whole, one that regularly gets smacked with costly weather disasters and faces even bigger problems in the future. Since 1970, the lower 48 states have warmed by 2.5 degrees, and Alaska has heated up by 4.2 degrees, compared to the global average of 1.7 degrees, the report said. But what people really feel is not the averages, but when weather is extreme. With heat waves, drought, wildfire, and heavy downpours, we are seeing an acceleration of the impacts of climate change in the United States, said study co-author Zeke Hausfather of the tech company Stripe and Berkeley Earth. And that's not healthy. climate change is, quote, harming physical, mental, spiritual, and community health and well-being through the increasing frequency and intensity of extreme events, increasing cases of infectious and vector-borne diseases, and declines in food and water quality and security, close quote, the report said. Compared to earlier national assessments, this year's uses far stronger language and, quote, unequivocally, close quote, blames the burning of coal, oil, and gas for climate change. The 37-chapter assessment includes an interactive atlas that zooms down to the county level. It finds that climate change is affecting people's security, health, and livelihoods in every corner of the country in different ways, with minority and Native American communities often disproportionately at risk. In Alaska, which is warming 2 to 3 times faster than the global average, reduced snowpack, shrinking glaciers, thawing permafrost, acidifying oceans, and disappearing sea ice affect everything from the state's growing season to hunting and fishing, with projections raising questions about whether some indigenous communities should be relocated. The Southwest is experiencing more drought and extreme heat, including 31 consecutive days this summer when Phoenix's daily high temperatures reached or exceeded 110 degrees, reducing water supplies and increasing wildfire risk. Northeastern cities are seeing more extreme heat, flooding, and poor air quality, as well as risks to infrastructure, while drought and floods, exacerbated by climate change, threaten farming and ecosystems in rural areas. In the Midwest, both extreme drought and flooding threaten crops and animal production, which can affect the global food supply. In the northern Great Plains, weather extremes like drought and flooding, as well as declining water resources, threaten an economy dependent largely on crops, cattle, energy production, and recreation. Meanwhile, water shortages in parts of the southern Great Plains are projected to worsen, while high temperatures are expected to break records in all three states by mid-century. In the Southeast, minority and Native American communities, who may live in areas with higher exposures to extreme heat, pollution, and flooding, have fewer resources to prepare for or to escape the effects of climate change. In the Northwest, hotter days and nights that don't cool down have resulted in drier streams and less snowpack, leading to increased risk of drought and wildfires. The climate disturbance has also brought damaging extreme rain. Brown University climate scientist Kim Cobb, who wasn't part of the assessment team, said at the center of the report are people across every region of the country who have escalating risks associated with climate change, as well as clear opportunities for win-win climate action. The United States will warm in the future about 40% more than the world as a total, the assessment said. The AP calculated, using others' global projections, that would slate America to get about 3.8 degrees hotter by the end of the century. Climate change is finally moving from an abstract future issue to a present, concrete, relevant issue. It's happening right now, said report lead author Catherine K. Hayhoe, chief scientist at the Nature Conservancy and a professor at Texas Tech University. 5 years ago, when the last assessment was issued, fewer people were experiencing climate change firsthand. Surveys this year by the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research show that. In September, 87% of Americans said they'd experienced at least one extreme weather event in the past 5 years: drought, extreme heat, severe storms, wildfires, or flooding. That was up from 79% who said that in April. But some scientists said parts of the assessment are too optimistic. The report's rosy graphics and outlook obscure the dangers approaching, Stanford University climate science scientist Rob Jackson said. We are not prepared for what's coming. On page 2, we take a dip into the arts with an article entitled Picasso Sketchbooks Reveal Hidden Gems. He was a giant of 20th century art, but that doesn't mean Pablo Picasso needed a big canvas. Matchbook covers, postcards, restaurant napkins, they all served as makeshift sketch pads for the artist at moments of inspiration. And so it should perhaps not be surprising that some of Picasso's actual sketch pads were well smaller than, say, a compact disc cover, like the tiny one now on display at Manhattan's Pace Gallery as part of Picasso 14 Sketchbooks, a new exhibit marking 50 years since the legendary artist's death. A stunningly complete self-portrait in pencil peeks out of that little book with deep and piercing eyes, all 3 3/4 by 5.5 inches of it. It was 1918, and Picasso, then in his mid-30s, had just married ballet dancer Olga Kokhlova. During a summer in balmy Biarritz, he painted on canvas, but also kept this tiny notebook around, filling it with scenes of their villa, the beach and the town, and sketches of upcoming paintings. He also drafted a letter to his wife's doctor and listed addresses of friends. The exhibit, which opened last week, is a collaboration with the Madrid Foundation, run by a grandson of Picasso's, Bernard Luis Ruiz Picasso. It comes nearly 40 years after the gallery's initial 1986 show of Picasso's sketchbooks, called Je suis le cahier, I am the sketchbook. After a notation Picasso made on one of his pads, which subsequently toured the globe. The show comes at a busy time for Picasso developments. Even in New York last week, where the artist's famed 1932 Femme à la Montre, Woman with a Watch, portraying his muse Marie-Thérèse Walter, sold for $139.4 million at Sotheby's, making it the second most valuable Picasso ever sold at auction. He is the greatest artist of the modern period, and in many ways, he thought of himself as a sketchbook, said Pace CEO Mark Glimcher, speaking to a crowd at a preview, referring to Picasso's efforts to refine his work through copious sketching. He sounded almost evangelical when he urged the young people present to recognize that everyone in this room sees the world differently because of Pablo Picasso. In an interview, Glimcher explained that he feels the world needs to be reminded of Picasso's achievements at a time in our culture where, he said, it seems everything and everyone is being questioned anew. He also noted what he called the icon effect. When something becomes so iconic, it becomes by necessity oversimplified, he said. People say, oh, Picasso got it. We have to make sure they do get it. The show, in one large gallery, is organized chronologically, spanning the years 1900 to 1959, most of Picasso's career. He died in 1973. Each of the 14 sketchbooks is presented in context with what was going on in his life, including in his romantic relationships, which figured so prominently in his artwork. Many of the sketches are early versions of famed paintings like La Demoiselle d'Avignon, for which one sketchbook tests out various figure renderings, Dora Maar in an armchair, and his War and Peace murals for a chapel in southern France that were finished in 1952. There is also a film of Picasso, shirtless and in shorts, preparing for those giant murals needing a ladder to reach the top of his canvas and reminding us of the dimension of some of his masterworks. But elsewhere in the show, the gems are in miniature size. Some of the images are fanciful, like the monsters and clown-like figures, some in bright blue and red pencil, from a 1956-57 sketchbook that resembles a whimsical children's book. And now on to national and world news. The first article, entitled "Vote Prevents Shutdown," House Speaker Forced to Compromise with Dems on New Proposal. The House voted Tuesday to prevent a government shutdown after new Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican from Louisiana, was forced to reach across the aisle to Democrats when hard-right conservatives revolted against his plan. The bipartisan tally, 336-95, showed Johnson's willingness to leave his right-flank Republicans behind and work with Democrats to temporarily keep government running, the same political move that cost former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, a Republican from California, his job just weeks ago. This time, Johnson appeared on track for a temporarily better outcome as the House approved the stopgap package to keep the government running into the new year. The Senate will act next ahead of Friday's shutdown deadline. But the new Republican leader faced the same political problem that led to McCarthy's ouster. Angry, frustrated, hard-right GOP lawmakers rejecting his approach, demanding budget cuts. 93 Republicans voted against the plan. Johnson had little choice but to rely on Democrats to ensure passage to keep the federal government running. Shortly before the Tuesday evening vote, House Democratic leaders issued a joint statement saying the package met all their requirements and they would support it. Under his proposal, Johnson put forward a unique two-part process that temporarily funds some federal agencies to January 19 and others to February 2. It's a continuing resolution that comes without any of the deep cuts conservatives demanded all year. It also fails to include President Joe Biden's request for nearly $106 billion for Ukraine, Israel, border security, and other supplemental funds. "We're not surrendering," Johnson said after a closed-door meeting of House Republicans on Tuesday morning, vowing he would not support another stopgap. "But you have to choose fights you can win." Johnson, who announced his endorsement Tuesday of Donald Trump as the Republican nominee for president, hit the airwaves to sell his approach and met privately Monday night with the Conservative Freedom Caucus. The House Freedom Caucus announced its opposition, ensuring dozens of votes against the plan. Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries noted in a letter to colleagues that the GOP package met the Democratic demands to keep funding at current levels without steep reductions or divisive Republican policy priorities. The Senate, where Democrats have a slim majority, signaled its willingness to accept Johnson's package ahead of Friday's deadline to fund the government. Next, an article entitled "Supporters of Israel Rally in D.C." Officials designate the demonstration a, quote, level one, close quote, security event. Supporters of Israel rallied by the tens of thousands on the National Mall under heavy security Tuesday, voicing solidarity in the fight against Hamas and crying never again. The March for Israel offered a resounding and bipartisan endorsement of one of America's closest allies as criticism intensifies over Israel's war in Gaza, set off by the Hamas incursion on October 7. Overlooking a sea of Israeli and U.S. flags, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, and House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries, a Democrat from New York, came together on the stage with House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, and Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican from Iowa. They joined hands as Schumer chanted, "We stand with Israel." Yet, underneath that projection of unity, Democrats are divided over Israel's course and its treatment of Palestinians. President Joe Biden now is urging Israel to restrain some of its tactics to ease civilian suffering in Gaza after voicing full-throated solidarity with the Israelis in the war's early weeks. A succession of speakers took the stage to denounce the Hamas attack and what they said was a virulent spread of anti-Semitism internationally, an embarrassment to all civilized people and nations, in the words of Israeli President Isaac Herzog, who addressed the crowd by video from the Western Wall in Jerusalem. Hamas militants stormed into Israel from Gaza in the surprise incursion October 7, killing more than 1,200 people and taking more than 200 hostages, according to Israeli officials. Israel responded with weeks of attacks in Gaza, which so far killed more than 11,000 Palestinians, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. The Homeland Security Department designated the march a, quote, level one, close quote, security event, the highest classification in its system, and one usually used for the Super Bowl and other major events, two law enforcement officials said. The designation means the event required substantial law enforcement assistance from federal agencies, the official said. The FBI and Homeland Security sent a joint bulletin to law enforcement officials in Washington, warning about the potential for violence or an attack, the official said. But the bulletin said clearly that federal officials didn't identify any specific actionable threat. Another article entitled Illegal Crossings into the U.S. Fall in October. Drop follows months of increased arrests at the Mexican border. Illegal border crossings from Mexico fell 14% in October from a month earlier, U.S. authorities said Tuesday, ending a three-month streak of big increases. U.S. officials highlighted the resumption of deportation flights to Venezuela on October 18, shortly after Venezuelans replaced Mexicans as the largest nationality appearing at the border. Arrests of Venezuelans plummeted 45% to 29,637 from 54,833, still second only to Mexicans. Arrests for illegal crossings totaled 188,778 for all nationalities in October, down from 218,763 in September, which was the second highest month on record. Arrests more than doubled over the previous 3 months as migrants and smugglers adjusted to new asylum regulations introduced in May. Arrests of Chinese rose slightly to 4,247, with 99% of them in the San Diego area, as more fly to Ecuador and make their way to the U.S. border amid a faltering economy at home. President Joe Biden has adopted an approach at the border that combines new legal pathways to enter the country with more restrictions on asylum for those who cross the border illegally. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for October 15, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. Thanks for listening. Hello, and welcome to the reading of The Messenger for November 15, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. The headline article on the front page is entitled, "Tis the Season. Mary on Main Street Returns to Downtown." Downtown Fort Dodge will have a very special visitor to help launch the holiday season with Main Street Fort Dodge when Santa Claus helps light up the area on November 27. Old St. Nick will start off by riding west up Central Avenue, stopping at City Square Park to light up the gazebo with Fort Dodge Mayor Matt Bemrich at 5 p.m. After that, Santa will head back down Central to Veterans Triangle Park at Central Avenue and 12th Street for the annual tree lighting event. Once those hundreds and hundreds of light bulbs are illuminated, Santa will head to the Wells Fargo building, 822 Central Avenue, for warm drinks and indoor holiday activities from 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. ISU Extension is volunteering their folks to help with two stations where the kiddos can do something, said Sharon Stroh, executive director of Main Street Fort Dodge. One of them is a postcard to Santa, and we have a little mailbox for it to be sent. And the other one is making an ornament, and it will be stamped on the back with the date and Main Street so that they'll always remember where they created it. Members of the Silver Cord organization at Fort Dodge Senior High School will also be helping out at the event, Stroh said. The Dariette and Artist May Coffee Shop will have their mobile trailer out front to serve free hot cocoa and warm apple cider to Santa's visitors. The gazebo and tree lightings will be the finale for Main Street Fort Dodge's Merry on Main Street Week. Merry on Main Street will kick off on November 22 with holiday shopping punch cards available at the various downtown merchants. And on November 25, downtown merchants will be welcoming shoppers for Small Business Saturday. Also on the front page, an article entitled Corn Soybean Harvest Almost Finished. Iowa's soybean harvest is nearly complete, and about 94% of the state's corn crop has been gathered from fields, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This is already 10 days ahead of the 5-year average for both crops, which matured more quickly this growing season because of drought and hot temperatures. Last week was more of the same. The state averaged about 7 degrees above normal and had almost no rain. The unseasonably warm and dry weather this past week offered Iowa farmers another suitable stretch to finish up harvest and tackle other farm work, said Mike Naig, the state's agriculture secretary. If the corn harvest continues at last week's pace, it will also be nearly complete by this week's end. Even though the percentage of unharvested corn is relatively small at 6%, that figure still represents a massive area because of the millions of acres that are planted each year in Iowa. About 750,000 acres were yet to be harvested at the start of this week. Another article on the front page is entitled Meeting Farmers' Needs, Stratford's United Co-op Adding New Bins Scale Office. Harvest season may be winding down, but there will be plenty of activity at United Co-op in Stratford this winter as old buildings are torn down, a large new scale is installed, a new office completed, and work gets underway on the construction of two new steel bins for the Southwest Hamilton County facility. The projects at Stratford are just a series of expansions and improvements that United Co-op has seen at several of its in-branch sites in recent years. General Manager Tim Scott said the purpose is simply to serve members better. We hope it goes as well as the other sites, Scott said. This is still about serving farmers better. United Co-op was formed in 1977 when independent cooperatives in Webster City, Highview, Flugstad, Stoniga, and Camrar voted to come together as one. The former Stratford Grain and Supply joined the United family in 1994. Today, it's a busy site and one that continues to grow. What's driving the expansion project is the need for additional storage to serve our customers, said Doran Stakey, location manager for United Co-op in Stratford. Stakey is already looking forward to the 2024 harvest season, when the site will have 1 million bushels in new capacity and faster grain legs to help speed farmers on their way. When completed, total capacity will be just over 2 million bushels to serve the needs of area farmers. We are building two 500,000 bushel steel bins, Stakey said. We've been short on storage for soybeans, and this will help take care of that problem. One of the new bins will be for soybeans and the other for dry corn. The bins will go up in the area where there are currently two wood houses dating to the 1950s and 60s. The current office, built in 1951, is in this area and will be brought down as well. A new office is under construction directly east, a short distance across town. Once those buildings are cleared, work will be able to commence on the new steel bins. One of the wood houses will be burned under the direction of a state coordinator and with the assistance of area fire departments. The other wood house sits too close to current storage and will have to be brought down manually. An important part of the project is a new grain leg that will help move things more quickly at harvest time, according to Stakey. We will have a new receiving pit for soybeans that will make it extremely faster for dumping than what it has been, Stakey said. We're putting in a 20,000 bushel per hour grain leg that's going to make things so nice. Stratford has been operating with two grain legs, one at 10,000 bushels per hour and another at just 3,000 bushels per hour. The smaller one will be gone, while the large one will keep on working. With the new 20,000 bushel per hour leg, we'll still have the 10,000 bushel one. Things will get moved along, Stakey said. Adjacent to the new office, construction is underway on a new scale, similar to what United Co-op has installed in recent years at both its Camerar and Stoniga sites. The new scale will be 4 feet wider than the current scale and make it much more convenient for today's larger equipment. Right now, we can't weigh duals and the bigger anhydrous tanks, Stakey said. The tractor has to pull all the way off, but the new scale will accommodate the duals. At 14 feet wide and 80 feet long, with a capacity of 200,000 pounds, the new scale will make it easier and safer to weigh any of the loads that come in. Sulan Scales, which did the project in Camrar last year, is the general contractor for the project. The design will be really nice, Stakey said. There is a bump out for the probe, so it will be easier to see them. We won't have to move the tractor and wagons in order to probe in more than one spot. Construction on the new office is already moving along and will be ready for employees to move in before demolition on the current site begins. It will be larger and provide a meeting room to welcome area farmers for meetings. Dan Bergman, our agronomy manager, is going to have a nice meeting room in there, Stakey said. Bergman will be offering winter meetings on seed and chemical options, as well as a chance to talk with customers about any of their needs for the coming season. Stakey offered his agreement and is looking forward to showing off all the improvement when the work is done. We're farmer-owned, and we want to serve them better, Stakey said. If we can move things more quickly here, that helps them get more done in a day. And finally, on the front page, an article entitled Taking Center Stage with Darrellyn Cook. Cook loves to interpret a character on stage. Portraying a role on stage is a lot like reading books for Darrellyn Cook. In fact, the chance to portray a character is something that the Fort Dodge Senior High School senior enjoys doing. I like being on stage because it is an extension of a story, Cook said. In a lot of books and movies, you get to see the character's thoughts and motivations, but only on stage can you ask, why am I doing this? How did I end up this way? How would I react to this situation? Therefore, each interpretation is different based on the person who is playing the character. On stage, Cook has found her comfort zone. I just take part in whatever, It seems that I am specifically designed for which roles, though? Said Cook. I mean, I love over-the-top characters, and I love being evil. So that's how it works out. Cook recently donned the pointed hat and black outfit for her character Beulah in Fort Dodge's rendition of Once Upon a Fairy Tale. She was also the Wicked Witch her eighth grade year in The Wizard of Oz. On stage, Cook enjoys the fact that it is not just about an individual, but more about the group as a whole. My favorite part of being involved in theater is being part of something big that a lot of people are invested in, Cook said. Also having a chance to be a diva without annoying too many people. Besides the stage, Dodger Sr. also loves being behind a microphone. They are both means of showing what you feel, but singing is an extension of yourself while acting is being someone else for a bit, Cook said. I like experiencing both sides of it. My biggest influences, I guess, are Marianne, my voice teacher, my parents, my sister, and Oscar, probably. Cook's schedule has been packed in her 4 years as a Dodger. She has been on the cross-country team and participated in half marathon class. She has also been in jazz band, choir, and orchestra. She played in the pit for the musical her sophomore year and was in the musical her junior year. Outside of school, she sings at McSweeney's and has participated in NATS and the Bill Riley Talent Search a year ago. She also plays jazz at church and enjoys going to youth group. She has a lot of favorite and lasting memories of being in high school. I will always remember my cross-country team. We were tight, and I love those guys, Cook said. I love those weekend nights where you are done working on homework and dealing with responsibilities. I love movie nights with my siblings, walking and talking with Oscar, or rabble-rousing with Maddie, Lily, David, and Lori Lynn. Cook is unsure of her plans after high school. The Messenger's editorial today is entitled Local Service Clubs Team Up for Foodraiser. New cooperation will benefit the community. A group of people dashed through a closed Fort Dodge supermarket Sunday afternoon, tossing groceries in carts as fast as they possibly could. No, they weren't looting the place. In fact, they were doing a good deed that will help hungry people in the Fort Dodge area. The people filling those shopping carts were members of Evening Lions, Kiwanis, Noon Sertoma, Daybreak Rotary, and Noon Rotary. The event was the 2023 Service Club's United Shopping Spree Foodraiser. The site was the Fairway Store at 1231 First Avenue South. When it was all over, $2,869.55 worth of groceries had been collected for the Lotus Project, Upper Des Moines Opportunity, Inc., Fort Dodge Community School District Food Pantries, Holy Trinity Parish Food Bank, and the Lord's Cupboard. This shopping spree emerged 3 years ago from an initiative of Kiwanis International that seeks to have all service clubs work together. The initiative was embraced by the other service clubs in Fort Dodge. Together, those groups came up with the concept of going shopping to support local food pantries. Each club was partnered with one of the food pantries. However, this shopping trip would not be a leisurely stroll through the aisles, putting this and that in the cart. Two members from each club were tasked with filling their cart with $500 worth of food. However, they only had 7 minutes to do it, so the club members had to hustle. It was probably a lot of fun, and the effort produced nice results for the local food banks. The fact that the members of those service clubs so willingly embraced the concept of doing projects together is good news for our community. We thank them for what they did for the food pantries and look forward to what they will do next. On page 5, we find an article entitled, illegal border crossings into the U.S. drop in October after a three-month streak of increases. U.S. authorities say illegal border crossings from Mexico fell 14% in October from a month earlier, following 3 months of big increases. The decline comes during the resumption of deportation flights to Venezuela, shortly after Venezuelans replaced Mexicans as the largest nationality appearing at the border. Customs and Border Protection said Tuesday arrests for illegal crossings totaled nearly 189,000 among all nationalities, down from 219,000 in September, which was the second highest month on record. While crossings remain high, the monthly decline is a rare piece of good news for a White House that has been criticized over its immigration policies. And next, an article entitled "Senate Panel Takes a Step Toward Ending Senator Tuberville's Blockade of Military Nominations." Senate Democrats pushed ahead Tuesday with a resolution that would allow for the quick confirmation of hundreds of military nominees, an attempt to maneuver around a blockade from Senator Tommy Tuberville over a Pentagon abortion policy. Almost 400 military nominations are in limbo, and the number is growing due to Tuberville's blanket hold on confirmations and promotions for senior military officers. Despite bipartisan outrage and pressure from members of his own party, the Alabama senator has dug in as he fights the Pentagon to end its abortion policy. It's a stance that has left key national security positions unfilled and military families with an uncertain path forward. There has been a lot of negativity and dysfunction in the Senate these days, but Senator Tuberville has single-handedly brought the Senate to a new low, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said at the Senate Rules Committee meeting where the resolution was approved. The panel voted 9-7 to approve a resolution that would allow the Senate to confirm groups of the military nominees at once for the remainder of the congressional term. The Senate has traditionally confirmed large batches of military officers together, but that process can be upended by just one senator who objects. The resolution will now head to the Senate floor for a vote, where Democrats will need at least 9 Republican votes for passage. While Republicans on the Rules panel opposed the measure, arguing that the move could erode the powers of the minority in the Senate, some have signaled they might change their minds if Tuberville does not drop the holds before then. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who criticized Tuberville's holds before the committee vote, said he would oppose the Democratic resolution at this particular moment, but he did not say whether he might vote for it on the floor. Of Tuberville, McConnell said that, unfortunately, our colleague has chosen instead to exert his leverage on career military officers with no influence over this administration's policy priorities. Tuberville has said he is open to negotiating an end to his holds on almost 400 military nominees, which he first announced in February, but he has not yet signaled that he will drop them. 2 weeks ago, frustrated Senate Republicans confronted Tuberville on the floor for more than 4 hours, calling up 61 of the military nominations, only for Tuberville to stand up and object every time. At the same time, Democrats started the process for trying to maneuver around his objections. Republicans who have criticized Tuberville have suggested they may try and persuade him to hold up civilian nominees instead of the military nominations, or take legal actions against the department, an option that Tuberville has said he's considering. They have also said they will also try to force more votes on nominations if he doesn't lift the holds. Tuberville is blocking the nominations in opposition to new Pentagon rules that allow reimbursement for travel when a service member has to go out of state to get an abortion or other reproductive care. President Joe Biden's administration instituted the new rules after the Supreme Court overturned the nationwide right to an abortion, and some states have limited or banned the procedure. I cannot simply sit idly by while the Biden administration injects politics in our military from the White House and spends taxpayer dollars on abortion, Tuberville said when his GOP colleagues confronted him on the floor. Senior military officials have warned repeatedly that Tuberville's blockade threatens readiness and national security. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has said the delays are hurting readiness and have unnecessarily weighed down our military families who already give up so much to support those who serve. Senate Rules Committee Chairman Amy Klobuchar, a Democrat from Minnesota, noted at the meeting that some of those military families whose lives had been disrupted were present for the committee vote. Senator Tuberville has not listened to his Democratic or his Republican colleagues, and many of them have now spoken out on the Senate floor, Klobuchar said. He's not listening to those who run our military. He's not listening to former military officials. So we need to stand up for our military and our national security and allow these promotions to move forward. And now in local sports, we have an article about St. Edmund football and honor roll. Eight Gales receive all district recognition. J.T. Loffersweiler ranked among the best quarterbacks in all of eight player this season. St. Edmund Sr. was honored for his effort by being named the District 9 Offensive Player of the Year. Loffersweiler was one of four Gales named to the first team alongside Grant Gallus, Coleman Hansen, and Adam Walker. Making the second team were Sam Meyer and Jacob Koopman, with honorable mention status going to Quinton Jaske and Kinnick Henning. St. Edmund finished fifth in the district at 2-4 with a 4-4 overall record. Audubon was first, followed by Glidden Ralston, Baxter, and Coon Rapids Bayard. Loffensweiler racked up 1,905 yards passing and 624 yards rushing with 35 total touchdowns. He completed 56% of his passes with a quarterback rating of 143.4. Over his high school career, Loffersweiler had 3,849 yards passing, 1,311 yards rushing, 46 passing touchdowns, and 26 rushing touchdowns. JT had a phenomenal career, his head coach Matt Dillon said. He was a tremendous leader and an even better person. JT broke every passing record at St. Edmund's and is going to make somebody very happy at the college level. I think the world of him as a player and how much he has grown as a person over this time period. Gallus, a sophomore, became the number one target for Loffensweiler, catching 46 passes for 867 yards and 13 touchdowns. He averaged almost 13 yards per reception while also handling punt return duties. Coming out of our team camp this preseason, we didn't know if Grant would be ready, Dillon said. When Dominic McLean went down versus Garrigan, Grant stepped in and really had an unbelievable season. Hansen, also a sophomore, had 37 touchbacks and was 7 for 16 on extra point attempts. On defense, he recorded a team-high 5 sacks with 37 tackles and scored a touchdown off a fumble recovery. Coleman was not only a weapon on defense, his leg made a big difference for us, Dillon said. You cannot underestimate how important it is having someone like Coleman who could consistently put the ball in the end zone on kickoffs. Walker, a junior, was in on 46.5 tackles, with 23.5 coming for a loss. He also had 2.5 sacks and was a starter along the offensive line. We were able to play Adam at various spots because of his abilities and skills, Dylan said. Every single district coach voted him on the first team because they understood just how good he was. Meyer ran for 451 yards with four touchdowns, adding six receptions for 80 yards and a score. The junior finished with a team-leading 69 tackles, including 7.5 stops for a loss. Koopman, a sophomore, recorded 40 tackles with 33 solo stops and 4 interceptions, while adding 136 yards receiving and a TD on offense. Jasky, a junior, had 51.5 tackles, including 11 for loss with 2 sacks, while also starting along the offensive line. Henning, another 10th grader, had 48.5 tackles, 10 tackles for loss, 2 fumble recoveries, and 278 yards of total offense with 4 touchdowns. We have an incredible group of players coming back, Dylan said. We've got to find a new quarterback, but I really like what we have returning. Trenton Beard of Colonesco was tabbed a defensive player of the year, with Charles Sean from Glidden-Ralston earning lineman of the year.